Hello, everybody. This is a discussion of the final exam for microeconomics, spring of 07. You can refer to a copy of the final exam, including the answer key, which is available along with this discussion. Feel free to load that into a separate window so that you can pause the discussion if you want to look at diagrams in the exam itself. Your version, which you took, the questions are in the same order, but the answers may have been scrambled compared to this exam. All right. Question one. Evaluate the following statements, then choose from A through E. Well, this is the question asking you to know who wrote The Wealth of Nations. And The Wealth of Nations was published in 1776 and was written by Adam Smith. Therefore, he did not write in the mid-1800s. It has nothing to do with the Great Depression. It was not written by Keynes. It was not written by Milton Friedman. It's very important for an educated person to know who Adam Smith is, and in this textbook you can find references to Adam Smith on pages 10, 20, 31, 39, 47 to 8, 75, 87, and 472. Question 2. Anyway, back on question one. So the correct answer is none of statements 1, 2, 3, or 4 are true. Question two. Which of the following statements best summarizes the text's conclusions regarding the likelihood of technological innovation in a monopolized industry? Now, this is not in the chapters that you studied, so it is hard, but when you think about monopolies and the profits that they earn, you need to realize that innovation does not necessarily improve a monopolist position. And innovation may change the elasticity of demand. So the correct answer is monopolists may earn the profits needed for research and development, but they seldom have the incentive to innovate. Now, question three. Which of the following is not a way that monopolies fight real-world competition? You can find this in chapter 12. Again, this is not something which is stated explicitly in Chapter 12, but when you think about a monopoly, monopolies want to preserve their position. And to do that, they're going to engage in a lot of activity, which you can infer through common sense. Producing products that are difficult to copy, that seems like an excellent idea. Advertising to make it sound like your product is different, that seems like an excellent idea. Lobbying the legislature to pass laws which make it difficult for competitors to enter the market, that's a good idea. But producing a bunch of goods that are similar to the goods of your competitors seems like an idiotic idea. So that is the correct answer. The not a way that monopolies fight real-world competition. This was an easy question. Okay, question four. Collusion is most likely to occur in, and the correct answer is oligopoly. And this is in chapter 13 on oligopoly. Question five. Long-run equilibrium for firms in monopolistic competitive industries is similar to that for firms in perfect competition. In what respect? Economic profit equals zero. The page reference is page 302 to 303. Now, question six. refer to the graph above. If the firm sets the price to maximize profit, what will it charge? Well, to do this, you needed to remember the process for determining the price and the quantity for any firm. And that process is to find the point where the marginal revenue and the marginal cost curves cross. If they cross more than once, find the point which has the highest profit. From that point, read straight downward to find the quantity. And from that point, go up to the demand curve and then straight over horizontally to find the price. There are many pages which show this. In the case of Monopoly, it's shown on page 281. And the diagram looks very similar to the diagram in your exam. The correct answer is that this monopolist will charge a price of $8 for its product. Question 7. A monopoly firm selling lemonade to tourists on an island is currently maximizing profit by charging a price of $5 per glass. It follows that marginal cost of lemonade, and the correct answer is less than $5. Two ways of figuring out this. The first is just take a look at the diagram up above where you have a monopolist. Marginal revenue and the marginal cost, those two curves cross at approximately the price of $4, but the monopolist will charge a price of $8. So the price that it's charging is higher than the marginal cost of lemonade, which for this monopolist in the diagram is $4. Another way of seeing it, though, is to realize that if demand curves slope downward, the marginal revenue curve is going to be lower than the price. Marginal revenue is going to be lower than the price. And therefore, since the correct output is the point where marginal cost crosses marginal revenue, then marginal cost is also going to be lower than price. So the correct answer is less than $5. Okay, question 8. Refer to the graph above. Given the demand curve, what is the marginal revenue curve? Well, I showed you how to do this in class, and there is a derivation, there is a description of the process on page 279 of the text. You can refer to your notes in class where I gave you a mathematical derivation, a proof of the technique that you use, which is basically find the vertical intercept of the demand curve, a straight line demand curve, and then go to the horizontal intercept of the straight line demand curve, and then cut the horizontal distance in half. Your marginal revenue curve goes through those two points, the vertical intercept and one half the horizontal intercept. Refer to your notes for that question. But the correct answer is C. Now, question 9. Blank activities are designed to transfer surplus from one group to another. The correct answer is rent seeking. And the page reference is pages 179 to 182. Rent seeking is a very important type of activity which interferes with the maintenance and working of competitive markets. So you can't really understand microeconomics without giving some attention to the existence of rent seeking. All right, question 10. Refer to the graph above. Given a tax of T on suppliers, revenue collected is, and the correct answer is, B and C. Suppliers pay B and consumers pay C. Now, the answer to this question is based on the important point I made in the lecture, which is that the person who actually collects the tax and sends it in is not the same as the question of who bears the burden of the tax. The person who bears the burden of the tax is the person, you might say, who truly pays the tax. So we make a distinction between the person who sends in the money and the person who truly pays. And so to repeat reading of the question, changing the wording, given a tax of T which is sent in by the suppliers, the correct answer is suppliers truly pay B and consumers truly pay C. You need to review your notes in order to see who pays the burden of a tax. In lecture, I showed you a formula which also exists in the text, which divides up the total burden of the tax between the sellers of the product and the buyers of the product. Question 11, if a consumer is willing to pay as much as $5 for a hot dog that actually costs $1.50, then the amount of consumer surplus resulting from the purchase of that hot dog would be, and the correct answer is $3.50. The page reference is page 167. Consumer surplus is the value in excess of the cost. The cost is $1.50. The value to this consumer is $5. And the difference is the consumer surplus. Question 12, according to the law of demand, as discussed in lecture, an increase in the price of a good, and the correct answer is, will never cause quantity demanded for that good to increase. Remember, the point I made in lecture is that when I discussed the law of demand, I pointed out that in the text, the law of demand is crudely stated, roughly stated, that if the price goes down, the quantity demanded will go up. If the price goes up, the quantity demanded will go down. And I said that is basically true, except that there are exceptions which can happen in reality, in which if the price goes down, the quantity demanded does not go up. The cases of very inelastic demand, and I use the example of purchasing air on the moon, you purchase a certain amount. The price went up, you would not necessarily buy less air. And so therefore the law of demand needs to be restated, and the way you can restate it is that if the price goes down, the quantity demanded will never go down. It'll stay unchanged like the air on the moon, or it'll go up like most normal goods. And so you could say that price and quantity demanded will never move in the same direction. That would be the law of demand as discussed in lecture. All right. And so the correct answer is an increase in the price of a good will never cause quantity demanded for that good to increase. Okay, now we come to question 13. Refer to the 9 labor leisure choice diagrams above and choose the best answer. The first statement is, as discussed in lecture, in the U.S. from the early 1900s to the present, the average wage rate has increased substantially and average the number of hours worked has decreased substantially. Figure 9 illustrates this. You take a look at figure 9 and you'll see that the wage rate is shown to increase, but with the higher wage rate, people are shown to work longer hours in figure 9. And so figure 9 does not show the typical person working fewer hours. Therefore, that statement is false. Statement 2, figures 1 and 4 each illustrate the impact of an increase in non-wage income on a person. Take a look at those and you'll see that the wage line is shifted upward parallel to itself in both instances. That can only be caused by an increase in non-wage income. Statement 2 is correct. Then, statement 3 says, figure 7 illustrates a pure substitution effect. Well, to get that right, you had to know what a pure substitution effect was. You could get that out of the appendix to Chapter 8 on indifference curves, or you could get that from lecture. I assumed that you got it out of lecture. And Figure 7 does illustrate a pure substitution effect. The pure substitution effect is a change in quantity demanded, which is caused by a change in prices without any change in your level of income or level of welfare. In Figure 7, the two dots are on the same indifference curve, therefore the level of income or welfare has not changed. Figure 7 does illustrate a pure substitution effect. So, reviewing all three statements, statements 1, 2, and 3, statements 2 and 3 are true. So the correct answer is only statements 2 and 3 are correct. To get this one right, you needed to have attended those lectures. Question 14. Which of the following would most likely generate a positive externality? Now, this is your chance to apply the concept of externality. This is not something you just read out of the textbook. The definition of an externality on page 40, impact on a third party which is not considered by the buyer and seller. So if the buyer and seller are trading a good, and when they trade it, there is a consequence for some third party, and the buyer and seller are ignoring that consequence, then there is a externality. If it's a good consequence, it's positive. If it's a bad consequence, it's negative. So you and I sell you a handgun, and now there may be negative externalities for little children who may find the gun and kill themselves. Okay, question, so the correct answer is for question 14, which of these is likely to generate a positive externality? Education. You get an education, and you're less likely to go to jail. You're less likely to commit crimes, and all of this saves me money and resources. Okay, question 15. The Sherman Antitrust Act declared what? Okay, the page references pages 342 to 343. The Sherman Antitrust Act declared any business combination in restraint of trade is illegal. When was the Sherman Antitrust Act passed? Maybe you'd like to know that. Okay, question 16. Some economists argue that a regulated monopolist's guarantee of a fair return on his investment damages the company's incentive to, and the correct answer is, control costs. Now, this was a creative thinking question. The problem is that if we have a monopoly, if a monopoly exists, you kind of have three choices how to deal with it, all of them bad. One is just accept the fact the monopolist is going to charge a monopoly profit. The second is to purchase the monopoly, own it, and operate it as a public a government enterprise like the post office. And the third is to regulate it. And when a monopoly is regulated, generally the monopolist is granted the right to a fair return. The problem with granting such a right is that if the monopolist is lazy or inefficient and has higher costs, if they're able to fool you, then they may be able to convince you that they ought to be granted a fair return on those bogus costs. So there's actually an incentive to create costs in the case of a regulated monopoly. So the correct answer is that guarantee of a fair return damages the company's incentives to control costs. Okay, question 17. In theory, socialism is an economic system, and the correct answer is a system that tries to organize society in the same ways as most families organize, striving to see that individuals get what they need. The definition of socialism is on page 60. By the way, that's not the definition, but that is the best answer of the options offered. Okay, question 18. Under welfare capitalism, the correct answer is markets operate, but government regulates markets significantly. And the page reference is page 87 to 88. The story is that Marx was wrong when he predicted the demise of capitalism, because he didn't take into account that capitalism itself would evolve and take on some of the characteristics which were necessary to prevent its demise. Now, question 19. A primary goal of the World Bank. Well, you'll find this the page reference is page 80. Primary goal of the World Bank is to foster economic growth in developing countries. Everybody should know what the World Bank is. Question 20. If the price elasticity of supply equals 2, then a 10% increase in the price will cause a 20% increase in quantity supplied. That's the correct answer. Now, the definition, you work this problem from the definition of the elasticity of supply, which is elasticity of supply equals percent change in supply divided by the percent change in the causal variable, which is in this case the price. Now, we know that the elasticity of supply equals 2, so E equals 2. And the percent change in supply is what we're trying to find out. That's the unknown. And the percent change in price is plus 10. So we have 2 equals X over 10. Multiply both sides by 10, and you have X equals 20.